Well, we finally have been able to actually see both what's on screen and on the blackboards and movement around and get audio, which is great for my final talk. So we have, well, hopefully that now we've got it sorted out as well, at least for the rest of the lecture course, the problems will be actually resolved. A couple of announcements, a reminder about homework handing in. At Guelph, people will need to hand in their assignments to Eric Poisson in the physics department before 5 o'clock next Tuesday. So that won't be handed in at the lecture, you have to actually take it to someone in the physics department and hand it in there. So I can write that up on the board. For people who are attending the lectures here in Waterloo, you will be able to hand in the assignment results to Freddie at the start of the lecture next Tuesday. Also, I'd just like to make a comment, particularly to some people at Quilt. There's been some people that have sent me emails asking questions, and I've been trying to respond to them, but there seems to have been some problems between the server here and the server at Quilt. And as a result, if you've sent me an email and you haven't received a response, it's quite likely that's the reason, so my apologies for that, and I will be trying to get a response to everyone who has emailed me. Okay, for the final talk on the introduction to quantum foundations, we're going to actually finish off looking at some of the interpretations of quantum theory that we didn't manage to finish last Thursday. In particular, we're going to look at further aspects of the de Broglie-Bohm approach to hidden variable theories, and a particular framework for looking at collapse theories. And we're then going to go on actually looking just simply into more general questions and say, maybe what we shouldn't be doing is trying to interpret quantum theory as we actually see it. Maybe actually what we need to do is something much more radical. Maybe we should reformulate it completely, cast it into a totally different structure. Maybe something about the mathematical structure we put it into in terms of wave functions and Schrodinger evolution, maybe that's not the right way to do it. And if we reformulate it, we might be able to see it in a different way, and some of these problems might be cleared up. Or maybe we should be even more radical than that, and say we should replace it altogether. Maybe quantum theory is wrong. Maybe you want to go beyond quantum theory. Does any of this give us some glimpses of how we can actually look for other theories? Now, there's some of the people who are working on attempts to marry quantum theory with general relativity are certainly asking questions about, is this going to require to have a new structure? And maybe some of the lessons we've learned from trying to understand quantum phenomena is actually going to be relevant to that work as well. So this isn't just about attempting to say, here we've got a mathematical structure, how do we interpret it? We want to actually try and go beyond it. Partly because much of the thing I've talked about in the last two lectures and the beginning of this lecture is essentially research that's been done. We've analysed the structure of certain types of hidden variable theories. We've analysed the structure of Everettian approaches. We've analysed the structure of certain types of collapse theories, and we've learned certain lessons from this. And progress has been made. But we don't actually, people who work in quantum foundations, by and large, we don't spend our time trying to rederive Bell inequalities. That would be a rather boring waste of our time, frankly. We don't spend all our time agonizing about the measurement problem, because we have analyzed these things, we've learned lessons, and now we're trying to actually move on and make use of those lessons. And I'm going to try and give some ideas of how we might be doing that. Could we have that door shut at the back, please? There is some noise coming through. So, just to recap from last Thursday, we had a look at the kind of many worlds approaches, and some of the problems with this, or some of the things we needed to understand. And one of the problems that one encountered in trying to understand no collapse, no extra structure approach to Hilbert spaces would be that they don't, the preferred basis problem, and that our perceptions seem to divide in a particular way. And to understand that without adding extra structure to Hilbert space, you actually say, well,
there's not actually a microscopic branching going on in the many worlds interpretation. It's actually our perceptions that divide. And decoherence is generally considered to have actually played a key role in making this work. Another thing we talked about was probability, that somehow the normal probabilistic assertions, the normal way of understanding, if I flip a coin 1,000 times and I see it comes up heads 3/4 of the time, I think it's a biased coin. This doesn't seem to work so well in the many worlds kind of context. And there's some recent work on a resolution for that called the Deutsch-Wallis problem argument, but it's still controversial. We mentioned yesterday that the Everettians seem to have a get-out clause on the locality argument, that one of the EPR arguments was based on this idea that I do something over here, and that seems to be associated with a specific determinate outcome happening on the other side of the EPR experiment. But in fact, the Everettian doesn't believe that there's a single determinate outcome. So perhaps the Everettian doesn't actually need to believe in non-locality. Maybe the Everettians actually have a way of actually avoiding non-locality. And this would make a reconciliation between quantum theory and general relativity easier. So Everettian approach is actually often being considered very attractive to people working in quantum cosmology for this kind of reason. It does raise a certain question, though. Is the wave function, we looked at what does it mean to say a theory is local, and some critics of this argument say, well, for sure you have local Hamiltonians, but if Everettians commit themselves to believing in the existence of the wave function as being the representation of what the world is the wave function itself a local object? Is it defined as properties existing in localized regions of space-time? And there is a kind of possible problem with that, in that suppose we just have some region of space here. And for a theory that's entirely about local properties, it would be there's an object and the object's in some region of space. Or we would look at some region of space and we would say that the electromagnetic field has some value in this region of space. And these would be locally defined objects. Now, if we have our entangled wave function, which has two particles, and we're going to label their coordinates x and y. Now, the x and the y are each coordinates in that space. So if we ask, what's the value of the wave function at that point in space? It doesn't actually have an answer. What the value of the wave function has is, it has a point, it has a value at a point where we say particle one is at that point and particle two is at that point, the wave function has a value for that. It has a different value for the particle one being here and particle two being somewhere else. You can't turn the two-particle wave function into a field on space in the way that, say, the electromagnetic field is a field on space. The two-particle wave function, or the three or four or n-body wave function, is actually is defined on what's called a configuration space. So some people would argue that actually, although the many worlds seems to have a get-out clause on the EPR argument, it's because its ontology just isn't actually locally defined. It's not about objects existing in space or a field in space. However, there is a further argument, counter-argument, that was put forward by David Deutsch and his co-worker Hayden. And they actually say that, well, you shouldn't actually believe in this wave function at all. They say that actually this whole picture of the wave function as being the real thing isn't actually the right picture. And they present a different idea, which is often described as operator realism. And the wave function, we might just imagine the wave function as being something that evolves and propagates, and we have the Schrödinger evolution for it. But every time we form a measurement, we do a measurement in some local region of space, and we see the outcomes in some local region of space. And we have some operator that we're measuring in that local region of space. And what's the Deutsch-Hayden argument says is really what we should be treating as real is not a wave function, but rather a property of these operators. And the operators are attached to regions of space-time. So this would become operator realism. Now, it has to be said, this is also controversial, and there are some arguments against this. And they often turn on the fact that we saw from our, when we looked at the operational definition of quantum theory, that we define the preparation of a thing uniquely by the wave function. And the argument is somehow that, well, the operator realism tries to just define everything in terms of operators, but you also got to have something that distinguishes the different outcomes of the operators. And when you actually try and introduce the all the various correlations and all the various statistical outcomes that quantum mechanics requires, this actually amounts to having introduced the wave function by the back door, and you've smuggled it in another way. And you will find that still there is in your mathematical structure, there's still an entity that corresponds to the wave function, and that entity is not defined locally. So we also looked at hidden variables, and we looked specifically at the de Broglie-Bohm approach to hidden variables. And as I've had one or two people ask me this question since that lecture, I want to make this very clear. The de Broglie-Bohm approach to hidden variables is completely consistent with non-relativistic quantum mechanics, and it reproduces all the results of non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Any no-go theorem that claims to prove you cannot describe quantum theory with hidden variable theorems can't be true because there's a definitive counterexample, and that is the de Broglie-Bohm theory. Now, there are additional qualifications. So we saw about the Bell inequalities. One of the things about such a hidden variable theory is it cannot be a local hidden variable theory. So certainly, we would agree that there is no local hidden variable theory that can reproduce all the results of quantum theory. That's not the same thing as saying there is no hidden variable theory. And that's the kind of qualification that sometimes gets missed in some of the literature. So you need to be careful of that. Well, we were looking when we ran out of time. Can everyone see this screen properly, by the way? There's quite a lot of glare. It's kind of bright, yeah. Yeah, so I'll just try and turn this, there we go. Thank you, Jacob. So we were looking at the way in which hidden variable theories work, and we ran out of time on last Thursday. So we have a wave function here, and this is a complex entity. It's got a magnitude, and it has a phase. And the de Broglie-Bohm essentially postulate, one of the key things was that to suppose there's an actual particle position, and it has a velocity that is guided by this equation. This phase of the wave function, this phase of the wave function is a field. It's a field on the configuration space of the particle. And that determines the velocity of it, and then we integrate along this, and we get a trajectory for our particle. And if we postulate just initially that the initial probability of finding the particle actually being at a particular position in space is given by the magnitude squared of the amplitude of the wave function, which would in normal quantum theory be regarded as being our probability of finding the particle there if we were to look for it, if we were to measure it, then it turns out that this holds true at all of the times, because essentially this guidance condition is just integrating along the flow lines of the probability, of the conserved probability current. We also had a quick look, well, what happens when we put a superposition? How does this deal with our interference effects? So we put in the superposition, and we found that when we look at the overall amplitude and phase, we get these rather ugly equations. But that if we have a situation where we have these two separate wave packets, and what we have is, we describe this as being they're non-overlapping in the configuration space of the particle. And just to explain what that actually means is, we suppose we have our regions of space, say the upper slit or the lower slit of a thing, and one wave packet is basically entirely concentrated in one region of space, and the other wave packet is entirely concentrated in a different region of space, then if we actually try and look, say, well, what's the value of the overall wave function if we pick some, it to be in here, the overall wave function at that point is equal to the value of just this wave function at that point, because this wave function has no support in that region. If we put this value of x into this wave packet, we get zero, because it's zero in that region of space. And when this happens, well, we put these amplitudes for this position x where we find the particle, one or the other amplitude is zero. Well, it turns out that if we plug that into this equation, suppose this is zero, this term disappears, this term cancels, we've got sine of SU over cos of SU, which is tan of SU, we take the arctan of that, and we just get back to SU. Which means that if these wave functions are non-overlapping, well, we find that the particle behaves as if it's in entirely in one or the other branch of the superposition. So if we think of our objects as being these particles, we can have situations where we have a superposition where the objects of these particles simply behave as if it's in one or the other branch of the superposition. And when they overlap, however, it doesn't, and we get this interference, and we looked at this. So here we've got them spreading out just as if they're in two separate wave packets, because the wave packets are quite separate. But as the wave packets start to overlap, we get these interference patterns appearing. Well, that's very well, but what happens when we have 2 degrees of freedom? What happens when we want to do a measurement? Because we had this point that when we measure which slit it's in, we don't see the interference. How does that happen? Well, what we need to do is we want to consistently treat the measuring apparatus as part of the same quantum mechanics. So that was one of the goals of any kind of resolution of the measurement problem. So we're going to have to say, well, okay, this is our measuring device, and we're going to have to provide a coordinate for this. So this is going to be y, our y coordinate. And we just do the same thing. We have our magnitude and our phase. We have a probability current. But this produces two coupled equations. First of all, we have our actual particle, the thing we're trying to talk about, the particle going, the atom going through the slit. But this now, it has, more or less, it's the same equation, but now the phase actually includes in it, it's this joint phase, and it includes in it the location of the big pointer. And similarly, the motion of the big pointer, or in general, any of the second system, has this dependency upon the phase of the joint phase, and the joint phase includes the position of the atom. And there's no time for the propagation of this. It's the way this pointer is going to move at this particular instant in time depends instantaneously on where the atom is, no matter how far away it is. In general, there's an instantaneous interaction between these 2 degrees of freedom. So this is the kind of thing one can point to and go, well, there. Well, that's non-locality for sure. So we said on Tuesday, yeah, you have to look at different theory and say, can you point to something that's non-local? In this theory, you definitely can. However, if we have a situation where the wave function factorizes, so there's none of this entanglement business, well, if you just plug this, if you put each of these two separate ones into their polar form, and you stick it into here, you'll find that the phase, the overall phase, is just the sum of the phase of this plus the phase of this. And because they're the sum, well, we stick that into a partial differential equation for x. We take the derivative of this with respect to x, and this with respect to x, well, that's partially derivative with x is zero. So we get this equation. This no longer has any y dependency. And for this, this no longer has any x dependency. In fact, they're just separated into two completely separate systems that are actually behaving independently. So I don't need to worry in this kind of situation that somehow what's happening to my stick here could just be because any atoms anywhere around the world are doing anything. It's only when this stick has become entangled with an atom around the world, somewhere that is actually going to have its behavior affected by it, which is useful. Because it would be rather hard to see how it could be the case if the behavior of this was somehow instantaneously dependent upon the motion of atoms in the vicinity of Alpha Centauri. It would be rather hard to do physics. But what happens if we do have these entangled systems? So here we've got a situation where we've sent the atom through the upper slit and we're trying to perform a measurement with our big stick and it's supposed to be pointing at you. All the atom's gone through the down slit and we've done the measurement, and if it was the down slit, the big stick's supposed to be pointing it down. Well, here, of course, we haven't got our factorization anymore, which means we have our big ugly expression again. Now here I'm using psi u as being phi u, psi u. So I've just introduced a little bit of simplification, because if I was to put all of these in here, that big ugly expression would be even bigger and uglier. But we've still got more or less the same form, and that means if we look at our stick, now our y coordinate for the stick is supposed to be some actual position of where the stick is. So this is some, then we have a wave packet, and we've got the wave packet for the stick pointing over here, and we've got the wave packet for the stick pointing over here. Now, if the actual atoms of the stick are over here, then if we put those, then the value of the wave packet, the down wave packet, in this region of space is zero. The value of the up wave packet in this region of space is zero. So if the atoms of the stick are actually in this region of space, then the value of the down wave packet is going to be zero for that point. So we've got the same result here. We can plug this in to here, and it cancels out this, which means it cancels out these, which means that we only have these cancelling out, and this becomes a tangent, and it goes in the arctangent, and we find that the wave function can behave as if it's this, and not only does it separate, but it separates in the following way. If y prime, so the actual location of the atoms of the stick, are pointing in the up, actually in the up position, then the wave packet of the stick in the down position has a zero value, which means that the atom then behaves, that the overall wave packet is as if it were factorizable, and the atom then behaves as if it was entirely in the up wave packet. So if I put the stick in here, the stick moves over to here. Because of the non-local interaction, the atom then behaves entirely as if it's in the up wave packet, regardless of whether the atom's up or down wave packets are overlapping anymore. Now, this is a bit of a subtle one. Because this is how measurement outcomes occur. And it's because the wave function is existing in the configuration space. As long as the wave function is non-overlapping in any one of the degrees of freedom, then the de Broglie-Bohm trajectories behave as if it's a statistical mixture, as if it's just a mixture of one or the other. So the interference disappears. So it's actually the measurement outcome. Performance of the measurement is actually what makes the interference go away, very clearly in the de Broglie-Bohm approach. Well, there are further things one could say about this. It's only one approach to hidden variables, I have to say. It's the one that's been the most studied, though. There are further aspects of it. It's always been supposed that there's a problem with quantum field theory. Actually, Bohm presented a way of doing field theory in his actual original papers in 1952, but it's generally been questioned as to whether or not it can actually be extended to interacting field theories, and this has often been a criticism made out of it, particularly because of this issue with non-locality and compatibility with relativity theory. Well, once you have to actually accept the fact that it's just going to be non-local and it's not going to be at the fundamental hidden variable level compatible with relativity theory, then it turns out it actually is possible to construct general interacting field theories. And that's recent work that's actually taken place from some people here at the Perimeter Institute have shown that. There are, of course, there is no reason why we have to pick X as our hidden variable. One of the ways in which this works is through using as the variable a field configuration. So it supposes that at each point in space, there is in fact a definite value for the electromagnetic field. That doesn't evolve according to the Maxwell's equations. It's guided by a super Schrödinger wave that doesn't exist in space at all. But there are possible other ways of constructing hidden variable theories. And some things have been presented, for example, could you construct them using spin of electrons? Can you attach hidden variables for that? Momentum, why position? Why not momentum is being questioned. People are suggesting even more complicated, abstract things that may or may not be possible. What's important is that in any situation where one gets a measurement outcome for these kind of theories, so in any situation where there's some macroscopic device that's pointing one way or another, that it had better be the case that the hidden variable is selecting one of those wave packets or the other in this way. So that if you actually say, what's the value of the wave function given that the variable or the hidden variable is in one location, it had better say that for the other wave packet, the value of that wave packet for the hidden variable being in this location is zero. Because if you don't get that, you don't lose the interference. You don't get the separation. You don't get the measured thing then behaving as if it is entirely in the wave packet that was measured. Perhaps a more serious criticism that's been leveled is on the idea of empty waves. De Broglie-Bohm is a no-collapse theory. And that means that the actual wave function continues to evolve, doesn't collapse, it's still there, and it is treated as a real physical object, even though it doesn't exist in physical space. And that means that although the atoms of the stick are pointing in this direction, there is still a very real physical thing corresponding to the wave packet of the stick pointing in this direction. Now, the Everettians in particular make a point of saying, well, look, we can take this to the point where I look at the stick, and if I see the stick's pointing it this way, I go home. And if I see the stick's pointing it this way, I go to the bar. And if I treat myself as being also described by the quantum wave function, then there is a definite thing in physical reality that looks like me going home. And there is a definite thing in physical reality that looks like me sitting at the bar ordering a drink. And just because there's this extra hidden variable that's supposed to pick out one or the other, why on earth am I actually treating one of those real things as not being really me, not being real? Isn't this just Everettian in a chronic state of denial? Isn't De Broglie-Bohm committed to the existence of this other outcome as a physically real thing? We just add this extra structure of hidden variables to try and avoid having to deal with that. And that's actually a very valid criticism. And one of the things that's also been suggested, there's actually another area of active research. It made an assumption about probabilities that the initial distribution of the hidden variables is given by the Born rule. And this guarantees agreement with quantum theory. But this is an additional assumption to the dynamics, and it's an additional probabilistic assumption that has to be made. It's been likened to making equilibrium thermodynamics assumptions. And it's been suggested this begs the question, what happens if we don't make this assumption? What happens if we suppose we have some source of electrons that we're sending off at a two-slit experiment, and we believe that the De Broglie-Bohm theory is true, but the initial positions of the electrons as they approach the slits isn't distributed with the probability given by Born rule? Now, in analogy to the thermal equilibrium, there's been attempts to show that for any kind of complicated, any sufficiently complicated system, that what happens if you don't have these Born rule distributions, that actually after a short amount of time of interaction, any probability will actually reach an equilibrium that looks like the Born rule. And most of these arguments are at least as good or as good as the equivalent arguments in statistical mechanics. What's more interesting is the possibility that maybe you can find situations where this relaxation to an equilibrium doesn't occur, and ask, is there actually any characteristic signature that we could look for? Because if we could look for this non-equilibrium distributions happening, we might actually be able to show that these hidden variables really do exist. And there's been some examination of the possibility that, for example, the early cosmological data might actually be the kind of thing which one can look at. So there's active research in looking at this. One consequence of this, has to be said, is it's almost at the state of a theorem at this point that any wave function realist hidden variable theory that is in non-equilibrium will allow faster than light signaling. So if we were to discover some signature of this, it wouldn't just prove that hidden variables exist. It would be pretty much tantamount to showing that relativity theory could not be a fundamental theory, which would be exceptionally shocking. So we're going to look at one of the next approaches, which is collapse theory. So we summarized the idea that leads you to collapse theory is the idea that the wave function is real, does represent the state of a physical object, but that just linear evolution isn't right. What really happens, the state of the world is actually just pointing over there or pointing over that. So let's not worry about these stupid empty waves or me going to the bar and me going home, because actually only one of them has really happened. Really, really only one of them has happened. And this requires linear evolution to not be right. Well, linear evolution has to change at some point. When? That's the key question one has to answer if one takes this approach. There's been a various stuff in the early days of the literature, and people said, well, it changes when things get macroscopic. It changes things when classical. It changes when we make an observation. It changes when some kind of irreversible process has taken place. All of which turned out to be inordinately hard to actually make precise. Macroscopic is 10 atoms. Macroscopic is of 10,000 atoms is 10 million. If it's 10 million, is 10 million and 1, or is 10 million minus 1? At what point does actually the linear evolution change and how? Classical just means that it's not quantum anymore. Observed, who gets to do the observation? Can a mouse make an observation, or do you have to have a PhD? Irreversible is really circular, because essentially linear evolution is reversible. So the only irreversibility comes in if you deviate from linear evolution, and that was the whole point we wanted to know. And consciousness is actually being suggested. Some people have actually gone to the point of saying, well, maybe it's just when it enters a conscious observer. Who's a conscious observer? Again, is a mouse a conscious observer? Well, that's something that's a really, really deep problem. And there's a vast literature on that question. It's quite important to get this precise, because as soon as you actually say precisely when and how it deviates, you can make empirical predictions. And that's good, because you can do experiments, and we can find out if it's true. And that's always very helpful to settle arguments. One of the most studied collapse models, which I'm now going to talk about, is the Girardi-Rimini-Weber model. And this essentially says, okay, it makes it precise by the following. It goes, for each degree of freedom, let's say an atom or a photon, maybe it should be electrons instead of atoms, electrons and protons and neutrons. Or maybe it's electrons and quarks. But whatever the theory is, we have a distinct number of degrees of freedom. There's a random chance of just a spontaneous collapse taking place. And the probability is 1 over tau, where tau is just some new constant of nature per unit time, and the unit time being the units in which we're expressing tau. So if tau was 1 hour, then in 1 hour, I haven't got that right. No. It'll be on the next slide. There's a particular fraction of probability in which you've got some probability that's taking place. I'll show it on the next slide. When the collapse takes place, the wave function changes. So we've got our original O wave function here, and it's got many degrees of freedom. And after a collapse takes place, the GRW proposal is the new wave function has this form. So all they've done is they just multiply it by this factor. And the collapse is supposed to have taken place in this particular x coordinate this time. So this particular degree of freedom has happened to be the x degree of freedom. That's why it's x here. And the y and the z and any other ones, they haven't collapsed. Now the key thing is this function could be any function that's more or less sharply peaked around x prime equals x. So they particularly suggested a Gaussian with a very tight fit Gaussian. But there's lots of other functions that can work. And to make sure that the function afterwards is still normalized, this n is just a normalization. And the form of that should look slightly familiar. And the second, final part of it is that the actual position that the collapse happens to is this x prime. So we start with this wave function, and we say the collapse happens in the x degree of freedom. What happens is the wave function is said to collapse onto a particular position, x prime. And x prime is selected with this probability density. Now, if you look at this and this, then you will actually see that that looks very much like our Born rule probability for finding the system in this wave function, as expressed as a wave function. What does this actually, how does this help us? If we just look at one particle, what we have beforehand we've got some wave function, and it's over our space. So we just say if we have some value of x, it returns a value, and we've got this field that's defined over the space. Then what we do is we have a collapse occurs, and it's picked to happen at some value x prime. So now we have a new wave function, but it has this fx minus, or x prime minus x, which is narrowly peaked around here as a multiplication. So what that means is for the new wave function, for any region that's not close to this place where it collapsed to, we actually put another x value in there. This portion of it is going to be very small, so the new wave function is going to be very small. So afterwards, the probability distribution of finding the wave, the particle, anywhere other than the region of the collapse is going to turn out to be very small. Because this has a probability amplitude squared that's very small anywhere where this is non-zero. And so here we've got this. Tau is equal to 10 to the 15 seconds, is one of the suggestions they made. What that means is the unit time is a second. In 1 second, the probability of collapse is about 10 to the minus 15. That's approximate. It actually works out slightly differently, but for 10 to the 15, that's pretty good. So the average time for the collapse is going to be about 10 to the 15 seconds. Again, approximately. When we deal with big numbers, those are always approximate. Those approximates are good. What happens if we have a superposition? Well, this collapses to that. Has that really helped us? Doesn't look very good at first. But suppose our superposition is such that here we've got an up packet and here we've got a down packet, and It's this kind of two packets, so they're very separated in space. Well, remember, this is pretty small for anywhere where any value of x far away from where the collapse happens. And these wave packets are non-overlapping, which means either one of them is going to be pretty much zero, or the other one is. Because if we have our narrow x, with high probability, it's only going to happen somewhere where the wave packet's non-zero. So it's going to have to happen either collapse here or here. If we multiply the wave function by this narrow peak around here, then we're multiplying this by something that's very much close to zero. So it becomes zero. But if the collapse happens here, then equivalently we're multiplying a narrow peak, which hasn't affected this, but does make this effectively zero. So one or the other of them becomes effectively zero. And that means our wave function has effectively become one or the other of the wave packets. And that's what we wanted. Of course, that took 10 to the 15 seconds to happen, and that's an awful long time to wait. Is that going to be a problem? Well, one thing is that's actually maybe not going to be a problem, because we know from our interferometry experiments that these superpositions can be held up for quite some time. So we don't want it to happen too fast, because we know that would be wrong. We would get no interference ever then. So let's take a large system, however. Now we've got our phi u, and now, of course, we've got many degrees of freedom, because there's not just one thing here. For the bone theory, we just said, well, let's just do a y that says where this is. But really, this is made up of lots and lots and lots and lots of degrees of freedom. About 10 to the 23. And now we've done our measurement. And again, now we're going to look again. We're going to pick out a particular atom within this stick. We're going to say that one's got the y coordinate. Well, provided there's no overlap in the y coordinate for this stick, and if one wave packet corresponds to there and the other wave packet corresponds to there, there better not be any overlap. And again, provided this function is narrowly peaked, then if a collapse occurs in the y coordinate of this stick, it's going to be onto one or the other wave packets. So if we look at, if we multiply this equation by our collapse, so a collapse occurs in our y coordinate, then the resulting wave packet for the combined system, including the measured atom, is going to be either up or down. And that's what we want. And that's nice. And what's especially nice is that that could have happened, we picked the y coordinate, but it could have happened for any one of the atoms or in this entire stick. And there's something in the order of maybe 10 to the 23 of them. So how long is that going to take? Well, that means on average that it's going to take about 10 to the minus 8 seconds. That's a lot shorter. That's a lot better, because that means what we've got here is a system that's really rather neat. If we have an individual quantum system of the kind we've sent through interferometry experiments, collapses don't take place for a very long time, and we get interference. But as soon as we get big amounts of systems, that are the kind of systems we see, collapses happen really, really fast, and we never see interference. And this is exactly what we wanted. But it's a very simple scheme to make it happen. The miracle is it took until 1986 for this to be pointed out, for this particular scheme. Now, there was actually another collapse model that was very similar, very like this, that was actually put forward in the 1970s by a guy called Philip Pearl. It wasn't studied as much for interesting historical reasons, but it wasn't really the GRW scheme was the first one that was really studied. And one thing you might notice, however, about this collapse is, if this collapse happens on the y coordinate, well, it happens for all the other coordinates as well. So as soon as I hit this wave packet with a y, then with a y collapse, well, the atom also collapses to one or the other. And that atom could be somewhere else entirely. So again, we've got the non-locality coming in. And we can point to this and we can say there's a non-local effect going on. The atom could be in completely different regions of state space, but suddenly it finds itself localized into one or the other region because of what happened to this stick somewhere else entirely. There are certain problems, however, that as a result of actually making this precise and studying these models, some interesting features have actually turned up. One of the things is that what we've done is when we hit something with this kind of narrow wave packet, the collapsing, it always generically is going to make the wave packet smaller. It's never going to make it bigger. Now, if we have some wave packet, and it's got some width, well, and we make that narrower, well, generically, that's going to involve taking out some lower frequency modes of the wave packet. You're not going to be able to fit in long wavelengths into the narrow wave packet. But the problem is, okay, narrow wave packets, therefore, have only higher frequency modes, but high frequency modes are associated with higher entropies. So generally, if you make that wave packet narrower, then the energy of that wave packet is going to be higher. Well, it turns out that to localization, that means that energy has gone up. It's not gone up in some, just it goes up and sometimes it goes down, and on average, it cancels out. It's actually slightly more worrying, perhaps, is that no, the energy actually goes up on average. Energy is created out of nothing. Hey, fantastic. Well, okay, now, some people regard this actually as a problem, that conservation of energy is such an ingrained feature of our physical theories that really we should be worried about this, and some people say, hey, well, there you go. Better is actually to say, well, just how much does it go up? And under the current most well-developed collapse theories, I believe the order is something like over the course of the existence of the entire universe, over the course of size of the entire universe, energy of the universe has increased by something like 10 joules, which is not very much. So we're not going to solve the energy crisis by this. Next problem is this relativistic invariance. This problem is going to come up in the problem is almost any attempt to understand quantum theory on a deeper level, there's going to be a paragraph saying, how do you deal with relativity? Explicit collapse models have been constructed generally in non-relativistic quantum theory. Making a relativistically invariant collapse model presents difficulties. There have been some suggestions for this recently. It's an area of active research. One idea is the collapse can take place on the backward light cone. Now, that would be interesting. The backward light cone is one of the few structures that would be relativistically invariant. So it's not impossible. This would be the equivalent of a kind of retrocausal explanation of Bell inequality violations. It's not impossible that it could be done. The other alternative is you just do as the Bohmians do and you say, well, maybe relativity isn't fundamental. Because the great thing about collapse models is they make empirical predictions. So the problem is, whenever you get a situation where you've got this stick, it's also interacting with the environment. And the environment generally tends to produce this effect of decoherence. And decoherence looks quite like wave function collapse. Can't explain wave function collapse, but looks quite like it. So if you want to actually genuinely say wave function collapse has taken place, you better make sure it's not just decoherence you're observing. And you have to get some very sensitive experiments to do that. So to date, there haven't been any experiments that have actually been able to probe this. But we are actually rapidly approaching the case. And maybe in the next 10 years, I would be surprised if we weren't able to either rule out or observe some empirical evidence for wave function collapse. Tails and signaling. There's a funny result that, yeah, we haven't kind of discussed, but suppose we have our initial superposition, and we have these two widely separated wave packets. And then a collapse occurs on one of the wave packets, and we have this narrow, so we're going to add this narrow function that collapses it to being this wave packet. Well, if we look really, really carefully, we've said it's effectively zero over here, which it is. But if we look really, really closely at this, and we zoom in on this area, and we magnify it, we're looking really, really closely, it's effectively zero, but it's not actually zero, we find there's still a bump there. And the size of this bump is incredibly small, but it's definitely there. It's there because although we're multiplying it by this very long tail, this tail is not zero. It's not zero, so it's going to go up slightly because we have this bump. Okay, but it's incredibly small. Why do you care, right? What does it matter? Well, first thing is, you can't get rid of it. Turns out that's quite remarkable. If you actually tried to make it so that, well, let's get rid of the bump by just making it some kind of step function and it's rigorously zero, well, you can show that that is inevitably going to lead to signaling violations when you try and put that into a relativistic context. Well, maybe we could do that. But certainly, if we're going to have the goal of trying to have a relativistically invariant theory, you don't want that. And that means you're going to live with a bump. Should you worry about the bump? Ask the question, what is the ontology of collapse models? Well, it's that the wave function is the physical world. So if we don't say anything more about it, that bump is, suppose we have a collapse that's me going to the bar, well, there's still a little bump in the wave function that corresponds to me going home. And to an Everettian, that's still, the Everettian doesn't care the fact that one of them in the element in the superposition has a very low weight. It's still a real part of the superposition. So if I want to believe in the wave function being all there is, then that bump is still actually going to have all the structure of me going home. And if I believe that's real, then there's still this real structure in the wave function in the world that corresponds to that other outcome. So the Everettian can turn around and say, okay, you've mucked around with the probabilities, but you haven't got rid of that extra world. It's still there. Well, one of the attempts to answer this, maybe, is to not believe in the wave function, to have collapse models, but not actually believe in the reality of the wave function. This is often called the flash ontology. What you believe in is what happens is, at the point of collapse, that's what reality is. Reality is a moment in which an event occurs. And reality is built up out of flashes of moments of events occurring. Another thing one does is one can say, well, they add actually some extra structure, or called a matter field. And the matter field is effectively done by averaging over the wave function, over the configuration space, to actually define a field on physical space that has a distribution of matter, not a probability distribution of matter, an actual density of matter that's given by the average of the actual wave function. So in that case, in those two cases, if I have the situation where do I go to the bar or do I go home, there's a flash that's me going to the bar. Or there's an addition to the wave function, there is this matter distribution, and if you look at the matter distribution, all of my matter is actually in the bar, and almost none of my matter is actually going home. But that's simply because the collapse happens. Obviously, it's more likely that I'm going to be going home and studying. I wouldn't be going to the bar, no. But this means extra structure. And it's often been stated that, you know, one of the things is that collapse models, nobody would look at a collapse model in which you have wave function collapse and hidden variables. But actually, that's exactly what this is. Another thing that people, yes?
Well, one of the things about collapse, obviously, is we can't force a collapse. I mean, collapses just happen randomly, right? Okay. Now, what we can do is if we correlate something to a macroscopic object, for most collapse models, we hope that the class model is going to be one that's going to, that a collapse is going to happen with high probability. So what you can do is you can have, I mean, in the kind of EPR Bell experiments, you're trying to do measurements of two separate locations. Are you talking about measuring of one particular degree of freedom or two different degrees of freedom?
One in two different spots.
Okay, yeah, so, yes. So what you do in the two-slit experiment, it's exactly what you do. You put a measuring device in front of one slit, and a measuring device in front of the other slit, and you've got 1 degree of freedom, and it collapses. And but the collapse you get is still always going to be one or the other. Well, what happens is all you've done is, let's see. See, while I put YZ, etc., well, Y could be degrees of freedom of corresponding to the detector in front of the upslit, and Z could be the degree of freedom corresponding to the detector in front of the downslit. All you happen is the very first degree of freedom that has a collapse is just going to collapse to one or the other. Now, it doesn't matter whether it's the object you're observing, the downslit detector, or the upslit detector. But it's going to instantaneously affect the state of the other detector as much as it's going to affect the state of the atom because of this non-locality of the collapse. So you always only will detect one particle, not two. If you... Now, this was one of the things that Einstein worried about. Maybe the problem here is actually we're treating the wave function as real. Is it necessary? I mean, wave function actually shares some interesting properties with probability distributions. I mean, we take the magnitude squared of it and we say that's a probability distribution. There are information theorists actually studying quantum information, draw very close parallels between the structure of wave functions and the structure of classical probability distributions. So this leads many of them to wonder that maybe actually we're just making a category mistake. We're treating something as a real entity when actually it's not. It's a probability distribution. It's an expression of our uncertainty about the world. So there might be extra structure to the world, hidden variables, but the wave function doesn't have to be part of the structure of the world. The wave function is just an expression of our uncertainty about the actual state of those hidden variables. And there's a word it's a very current active point of research. And there's a phrase that's being used to refer to this as psi epistemic. Epistemic meaning knowledge. It's about our knowledge, not actually about the world. And it contrasts with traditional hidden variable theories, which are described as being psi ontic, because they treat the wave function as being an ontologically real thing. Can we actually do it is the actual question, though. Well, it would be cool if we could do it. Because wave function collapse would then just be this updating of our knowledge. This wouldn't be entirely true. I mean, you do actually have to have some kind of interaction in terms of measurement. It wouldn't just simply be we see what happens, we change our probabilities because we just saw something. I mean, if I flip a coin and I hide it under a cup, and you have a probability it's up or down, or heads or tails, and I show it you, you'll update your probabilities, usually, to say probability one it's heads or probability one it's tails. But that doesn't actually mean anything about the world's changed. Well, another really interesting thing is this would mean these empty waves or these bumps or whatever, these wouldn't be real. That would just be, I lift up the cup, I see that it's heads, I don't believe that there's an additional reality in which there's a coin showing tails. It was showing heads and I updated my probabilities. Now, the structure of a psi epistemic theory is often described as being this way. To build a psi epistemic theory, what you would need is to have this. We have our probability of getting, we have some measurement of some observable, and we get an outcome, a particular outcome, given the wave function. And to construct a psi epistemic theory, what we need is to have some hidden variable, which I've labeled with this chi, and we get a probability of getting the outcome given the hidden variable, a probability distribution over the hidden variable, and the value of this psi only corresponds to the probability distribution over the hidden variable. So this is just a subjective uncertainty about what the value of the hidden variable is. Now, I haven't said that the hidden variable determines the outcome. I've quite explicitly put
probabilistic statement in here. So if we look at what are called psiontic, there's a problem with this scheme, though. Now, there have been suggestions made for this. In fact, there was a suggestion made for exactly this in 1973. But it was discovered that it doesn't work for a problem. For psiontic theories, these are these ones where we believe that the wave function is real. If we say X, we denote that as being the state of the world, and everything in the world, and everything that we say is physically real. Well, what we have is we have the wave function and we have this extra structure, which means if we specify the state of the world, then we have specified what the wave function is. The attempts to construct psi epistemic theories originally seemed to be quite successful. Then it was noticed the following problem. To actually get them to reproduce all the results of quantum theory, you would find that this particular probability distribution, we have two separate wave functions, a psi prime and a psi. And we look at them, they ended up satisfying this equality, which means that for any given hidden variable state, psi, chi, that the probability for that was zero, was non-zero for one and only one wave function. So if we look at this as being a state space of the hidden variables, so we have the chi is the state space of the hidden variable, and then we would want to have a probability distribution over that state space, over the possible values for that hidden variable. Well, it would turn out that you effectively partition this state space up. By the different values of the wave function. So the probability distribution that produces psi was non-zero only for a particular set of hidden variable states. And for psi prime, non-zero only for a completely different set of hidden variable states. And any given hidden variable state could only ever fall in one of these probability distributions. And this had an immediate result. If you knew the hidden variable, you could read off what the wave function had to be. And this was exactly what the psi epistemic theory was trying to get away from. So again, you have this criticism. You're trying to eliminate being realistic about the wave function, but somehow you've got extra structure in your theory that doesn't allow you to do that. Now, there has been some in the last year or two. At the very least, a toy model that appears to actually avoid this. But it's a very toy model and it's still under development. But this is definitely a very current, active state of research. There is, to my knowledge, no theorem that so shows that this is inevitable. It's just the case that so far, for any kind of serious attempt to develop a psi epistemic theory, they've so far fallen into this trap. But there's no proof that it has to my knowledge. Well, here's a very famous no-go theorem that was developed about non-contextuality and contextuality. And we're really moving on to the advanced stuff now. Suppose we just want to say, well, okay, let's try and develop further structures and further theories. We know that our theory of a hidden variable theory is going to have to be non-local. Okay, but, you know, accepting that it's non-local, does that mean that we can then actually say that measurements have predetermined outcomes? I mean, we know that the idea that measurements have predetermined outcomes is incompatible with locality in quantum theory. We know you can't have a local deterministic hidden variable theory. But can I have a deterministic hidden variable theory that's non-local? And there was an argument that you can't. And so suppose we're actually going to perform a measurement, and the measurement has three outcomes, and we're representing those measurements by three different wave functions, A and B and C. Well, this idea is that there's something in advance that tells us whether or not we're going to get the answer A. And we call that the value rule. So we're going to get A, 0 if we're not going to get A, 1 if we're going to get A. And straight away, it has to be the case that these are going to add up to one, because we're going to get one of them, and we're not going to get any of the others. But quantum theory allows us to do a different measurement as well. It can allow us to measure A, and it can allow us to measure D and E, D and E being two different things. D and E generally being expressed as superpositions of B and C. But we've got the same A. Well, same rule has to apply, right? And there are certain assumptions that go into something called the Cochen-Specker theorem. One thing of value definiteness is let's try and construct a hidden variable theory in which everything we could possibly measure has a definite value. In other words, there's some aspect structure of the world that tells us what the outcome of the measurement is going to be before we make the measurement. And we can do that for every single possible observable. And that's what this function is supposed to give us. And non-contextuality supposes that the following. If it possesses a property, then it's independent of the measurement context, of how we do the measurement. And we saw that these phis, we only did our operational quantum theory, these are equivalence classes of different measurements, different physical arrangements, but they're equivalent because they're supposed to be measuring the same property. And what we want is this value rule really to actually tell us about that property, and we want it to say that that result of measuring that property is something about the physical system, and that that non-contextuality is actually really there, that these different arrangements that are supposed to measure the same property really are returning the same thing. If we'd have chosen to do a different way of measuring the same property, we would have still got the same outcome. So this property has got to be 0 or 1, regardless of whether we're choosing to measure it as B and C or measure it with D and E. It turns out that isn't possible. More or less because it's equivalent to painting a ball red and green in a special way, which is apparently well known, you can't do. So this example is actually by Perez, although the drawings are actually borrowed from somebody else who didn't credit them to Perez. So we can have a quantum system in which you can represent the three outcomes by being, say, an XYZ axis. And they're pointing to different points on a sphere. And you can set up those three things so that you have to have one of them pointing to 1 and the other one pointing, the other two being 0. And you can think of this by you can make the 1 green, a green paint marker, and the zeros being a red paint marker. And to fulfill these criteria, all you have to do is you have to be able to pick values of rotating all these around every possible angle on the ball and paint this sphere a combination of red and green in such a way that at any point that if I pick out green, I know that the two perpendicular directions are going to be red. And this is a famously impossible task in mathematics. But we don't need to paint the entire ball to actually see that. We only need to pick out a certain number of angles, which I'm going to do very quickly. So here we've got ones and zeros here on this example, but we could do them the other way around, it doesn't matter. So we can pick, here we've got our red dots, and here we've got our green dot. But the thing is, once we pick that as being a green dot, then we know that everything on this entire circumference has got to be a red dot. Because everywhere around that entire circumference is going to be on the perpendicular directions. And all we then do is, we then go around that and we follow that in, and we paint all the dots, until we end up finding a dot here that turns out has to be simultaneously red and green, which is impossible. And that means that basically we cannot say that every observable has an outcome that's set independently of how we choose to measure it. Should we be worried about this contextuality? There are some people who worry about this a great deal and consider it to be very deep, and there are some people who say this is very trivial. So one of the triviality arguments would be like this. Suppose I have a coin, and I'm going to flip it, and my phi A is going to be, is it going to come down heads? And my B and C is I'm going to weigh it to determine whether it's a dollar or a $2, a loonie or a toonie. Okay, so that I will have some kind of system in which I drop a coin, and while it falls, I measure its interactions. It bounces off things, and I see how it bounces off, and I figure out what its mass is. And then when it lands, I shine a light off it and see whether it's heads. And my D and E is going to be that I flip the coin and it falls down, but I'm going to measure its size instead of its mass. That means I have a different set of slots that it can fall through. Should I expect that it's going to come up heads independently of which way I measure it? Well, it's unlikely. I mean, suppose I was to drop it in there and I could say, well, maybe there is something deterministically that's going to tell me it's going to land up heads. But there's no reason to assume it's going to be the same. It's also going to come up heads with a different physical apparatus. And the different measurements are certainly going to have to be, in quantum theory, or at least going to have to be actually implemented by different physical apparatus. Now, classically, of course, we could set up an apparatus which looks whether it came up heads and simultaneously weighs the coin and simultaneously tells you how large it is. Quantum mechanically, we can't. We need different physical apparatus. So why do we assume that there's this value rule that says it's going to be phi A, and that's 0 or 1, regardless of the actual physical apparatus one uses? And in terms of, say, a de Broglie-Bohm hidden variable theory, which is a deterministic hidden variable theory, by some definitions the word deterministic, it is contextual. It is contextual in precisely this way. The manner in which you choose to perform a measurement affects the result you get. So I could be performing a spin Z measurement, and the same wave packet, the same initial state of the hidden variable, will produce a different outcome depending on how I choose to perform the measurement. Well, some people say that all this hidden variable stuff is really, really missing the point. Maybe all of this is just actually beside the point. Perhaps we should be understanding quantum mechanics as a theory of information. All of this quantum mechanics, it seems to be about restrictions on what we can know about a system. Maybe we should take that seriously. Maybe we should actually say, this is actually not about funny properties about things in the world. This is actually about our ability to know things. And that the fact that all these things about measurements is, classically, we assume that when we acquire information, we can do so without changing the thing. But maybe when we're acquiring information, this is actually, we're interacting with the system we're acquiring information about, and in the process, we create the very information that we acquire. Maybe it wasn't something there that we found. Maybe we actually formed it. Hey, in fact, a lot of hidden variable theories and collapse theories work in this way. But the information theorist approach would say, look, maybe that's actually, don't even talk about collapse. You don't need the collapse or the hidden variables extra structure. Just go to this idea of all we're doing in physics is we're making observations, we personally are making observations, and we're getting information, and we're correlating that information. Maybe we should concentrate on that. What quantum information gives us then is restrictions on how much information may be known, and if there's a limited capacity to a system, then new information must invalidate old information. It seems physics is a sequence of yes-no questions with limited storage. We ask questions of the world. The world replies yes or no, but then when it says yes, it changes its mind about what it said before, because it can't hold that many yes-no questions in its memory at the time. The quantum state we've seen in the operational interpretation is just a disposition to provide particular answers to particular questions. So asking a question replaces making a measurement. Does this help? I'm not too sympathetic to this whole approach, I think. But I don't want to denigrate it, because there are people that seriously work on it and are trying to genuinely put structure onto this and actually make this work as something that's quite rigorous. Uncertainty and complementarity is another thing that people work in. We haven't really talked about these ideas since the first lecture, but the Heisenberg uncertainty relationships, this is still part of the mathematical structure of Hilbert space. Any interpretation of quantum theory is going to have to deal with that. is going to have to explain the Heisenberg uncertainty relations. It might be helpful if we knew actually what they were then, really, if we made them more rigorous. Maybe this, because we worried about some of the kind of wave-particle duality arguments as they were a little bit unrigorous. So what do they actually mean? Is it disturbance of a momentum value by making a precision measurement? You'll often find out, I measure the position, and in doing so, I change its momentum. Well, that's actually not quite right. Perhaps more accurately would be to say there's a spread in the variation of position and momentum values when I make equivalently prepared systems. So what I do is I get a large number of systems, and I prepare them equivalently in their operational form. So they all each and individually is described by the same wave function. And then for half of them, I measure the position. Half of them, I measure the momentum. And I look at the variance in the position and the momentum, and I find that satisfies the uncertainty principle. Now, I didn't do position then momentum measurements on any individual system. I either did position or I did momentum. Even that's not actually fully true, because it's even possible, using more advanced techniques, positive operator value measures, to actually simultaneously get an approximate measurement of the position and an approximate measurement of momentum by a single experimental arrangement. But again, the approximate measurement of the position and the approximate measurement of the momentum is going to obey the uncertainty relation. So this is all making much more precise what exactly these terms are. And in general, it involves these called positive operator value measures, which anyone who goes into quantum information is really going to have to learn. Or unsharp measurements are sometimes referred to. One of the things it allows is a really neat thing, which a lot of people don't know about and contradicts something you're often told. You might be told that there's no measurement that can actually tell you what a wave function is, because you can actually, as soon as you try and measure it, you collapse it. You can disturb it. You can't tell what the wave function was. But if you actually think about the way we define the operational quantum theory, that shouldn't be the case. There is measurements that are called informationally complete measurements. Now, what you can't do is plug in one of the possible wave functions and find out in one experiment, bing, it was this wave function. But what you can do is you can have a measurement apparatus that you run it on a number of equivalently prepared systems, and you look at the statistical outcomes you get from that, and the statistical outcomes uniquely tell you what that equivalent preparation was. So you can actually, from a single measurement or a single apparatus, you run it a number of times on equivalent prepared systems, you can find out uniquely what the wave function was. And of course, it's not just all about position momentum. There are also trying to understand energy-time uncertainty relationships, and there's an equivalent sort of complementarity in photons between the phase of the electromagnetic field and the number of photons in the electromagnetic field. There are also uncertainty relationships involving angular momentum, or more or less any set of non-commuting observables. And again, there's a lot of work on trying to make these precise and actually understanding exactly what it means. Certainly, the energy-time uncertainty relationships require a quite different understanding, because time is not an operator and not an observable. Or maybe we're just actually doing it completely wrong and we should reformulate quantum theory altogether. We know the Schrödinger picture. We have a wave function it involves. There's the Heisenberg picture, which you particularly start to develop when you go into field theory, for example. And this actually tries to say, well, no, you get rid of the wave function as much as possible, and instead your observable evolves in time. And you can show an equivalence between these two pictures. Now, this is actually very much closely related to the ideas of operator realism, where you actually try and get rid of the wave function as much as possible. Now, you can't actually get rid of the wave function, because you still have the wave function as an initial condition, even in the Heisenberg picture. But that initial condition doesn't change. It's just a fixed thing. More complicated, we have the path integral formulation by Feynman, where we have some classical action, and then we have this exponential where we integrate the classical action over a particular path. And then what we do is we integrate over all the possible paths that can take. And we find that as a propagator, and this gets us out of wave function. It's big, ugly, horrible integral involving integration over paths, which generally doesn't actually converge. And turns out to be exactly equivalent to the Schrödinger and Heisenberg picture, except possibly in cases when we go to field theory. Indeed, people working in field theory and in quantum gravity will often be much preferring this format because it actually appears to work a bit more easily. Believe it or not, it'd be hard to tell that that's going to work more easily, but actually it does. There's also a history's formalism, which is similar to the path integral, and when we go to field theory, often becomes a form of path integral, in which we suppose that what actually happens is we have a sequence of events. And this is, at some particular time zero, some event I takes place. At time one, some event J takes place. All the way through to at time N, some event L takes place. And these events are equivalent to like our flash ontology events of a thing happens. And it's expressed by a wave function that's equivalent to a wave function of something happening. And there's a mathematical operation one can define for a weight, which is taking this trace of this history operator. And this is more or less the same as we take our wave functions and we plug it into our integral and we do our integration. And the probability of the history then just is when we normalize these weights. And the attempt to do the history's formalism actually really was an attempt to develop a new interpretation where we could say that we have a number of possible histories and one actual history of events occur. As a reformulation, if we have a set of histories to be able to actually apply for this to produce normal probability, there's a particular rather complicated expression has to occur. Now, it's not that that is a problem in itself. It's rather a nice guideline because it is the necessary and sufficient conditions for a set of probabilities to be applied to a sequence of events occurring. Did the electron go through this slit and then that slit and then arrive at this point is a sequence of events. The problem is there's no guidance on which collection of histories. And for any sequence up to one point, one can always conceive of a future events that could possibly occur with non-zero probability that will mean earlier events which previously had passed this criteria cease to pass this criteria. And what this means is we could consider this event to be going through the upslit or the downslit, and everything looks consistent up until that point. But this event is we observe an interference effect, and then it suddenly that's no longer consistent. And if this ontology is supposed to be the event actually occurred, this history actually occurred, well, then we're back to this whole problem. How do we make sense of the fact that it actually occurred, and then at some future point, some other event occurs, which means it didn't actually occur? And somehow our language has gone wrong. In fact, although there are advocates of this as an interpretation, to many people it is simply a reformulation, and that the only way to actually really make the language consistent, one either has to provide the criteria for which set of histories really do occur, and then you become a form of collapse theory. Or you say, well, all histories do occur in some sense, and you find yourself in an Everettian situation. Well, there's other attempts to reconstruct quantum theory by trying to get axiomatic about it. And these are based on trying to say what's different to classical theories, to some extent. There's an idea that theories such as the theory of relativity or thermodynamics are constructed from prohibitions. That relativity theory can be constructed from the idea that influences can't propagate faster than light. Thermodynamics from the fact that you can't make energy flow from colder to hotter. It is impossible to do this, it is impossible to do that. And from a conjunction of these, one can actually construct physical theories, which is kind of remarkable. So there's actually an argument by Clifton, Bubb and Halverson to trying to construct quantum theory on a similar attempt. And the three principles they claim is no cloning, no signaling, no bit commitment. No signaling we have it encountered. No cloning is actually you can't make an exact copy of a quantum system. No bit commitment is something really obscure in quantum information theory that I'm not even going to try and tell you. which is a bit of an odd thing, because to some extent, when you want to construct these principal theories, that you try and make them kind of intuitively sensible things that you might say, well, reasonably, you can see that the universe might be constructed to be this way. You cannot signal faster than light. Why would you construct the world in such a way that you can't do bit commitment, whatever that is? I don't know. But this is actually just an example of a number of ways in which there's active research in trying to reconstruct quantum theory from a minimum number of axioms. And in doing so, one can study the difference between the equivalent ways one can construct classical theories. We can also generalize them as well and actually try and construct theories that are not quantum theory or classical mechanics, and obey a different set of axioms. Unlike that, another way of approaching this is generalized probability theories. A lot of quantum mechanics, we talk about probability, and we find we have difficulty understanding some of the statements we would want to make in probability. Well, maybe one of the things we want to do is actually change our understanding of probability. So there's a number of axioms for probability theory, and we might want to weaken them. There's an idea that you have some fundamental states and you can ultimately reduce anything to a unique set of states and a probability distribution over them, and that those states always have this structure where either one or the other happens. And you might want to remove that. There are certain axioms that people might regard as being unreasonable. Generalized logic. Propositions about it. You might want to try and understand all these wave functions as being a proposition about a system, a logical proposition. The King of France is bald, this stick is pointing in this direction, not as being a statement about reality, but as a logical proposition, and then there are attempts in which you can change logic. Now, the study of generalized probability and generalized logic exist in themselves quite aside from quantum theory, and there are lots of ways one can do these things. One has to always remember what's the purpose of this. So there are, for example, fuzzy logics. Now, fuzzy logics don't match quantum logics. They're not the same thing. The thing to remember about these is it's similar to when you go to non-Euclidean geometry. You can construct Euclidean geometry with Euclid's fifth axiom, which can be stated, one version of it would be the angles of a triangle always add up to 180 degrees. There was a feeling that that should be derivable from the first four axioms, and in the 19th century, a lot of mathematicians tried to prove that and failed. Along the way, they discovered something remarkable, that you could have other geometries in which the angles of a triangle didn't add up to 180 degrees. But it took them a long time to do that, because so much of your intuitions, so many of our proofs, depended on, were worked through with assumptions that the angles of a triangle added up to 180 degrees. It's not enough to say, well, I can't prove that the angles of a triangle add up to 180 degrees from the other axioms, so maybe they don't. You have to actually work through the consequences of that and find out you're not going to get into trouble. It's not going to lead to some kind of contradiction. You have to show that these non-Euclidean geometries are actually consistent geometries. And it was a triumph of 19th century mathematics that they did, and it then led it to a triumph of 20th century physics. If you're going to change probability theory, if you're going to change logic, you can't just say, well, maybe it's true that A and not A is true. Because on the face of it, that's a statement that if you assume that, so many other things in logic are going to fall apart. You have to do a lot of very hard work to show that you can actually get consistent structures. But there is a massive literature on this, because it's something that stands quite outside of quantum theory as well. We also do something constructing what are called toy models. Toy models are models which we have no pretense that they're going to actually end up being a description of the entire universe. We're not pretending that. What we're just going to do is we're going to focus on particular phenomena, little particular constructions, and see how we can understand particular problems. And there are two kinds of ways these can work. One is we actually try and produce a toy model that's not going to reproduce all of quantum theory, but it is going to reproduce some characteristic quantum effects, and we want to study particularly how do we understand that effect. How do we explain what do we actually think was important to that effect? One of the things that motivates this idea is that there were certain results in quantum information theory that quantum theory requires entanglement to do. And it was supposed, oh, well, these are the characteristic quantum non-locality things, aren't they, then? And then someone actually pointed out, well, actually, no. Although quantum theory requires entanglement to do it, it's funnily enough, one can still construct a local hidden variable model that can do these things. So reality doesn't require non-locality to do it. Quantum theory might require it. What does that mean? Classical mechanics may or may not be able to do these things. Classical mechanics can't do dense coding. Well, classical mechanics actually can do teleportation. This is quantum teleportation type ideas. Theories which do not violate Bell inequalities, but do violate higher order inequalities. So non-locality, often defined on the basis, I'm nearly come to an end, by the way. you can find the Bell inequalities are all defined in terms of two possible things I'm measuring, two possible outcomes, or you can, and between two possible objects. Well, you can go to measurements that have 3, 4, 5, 6 possible outcomes. You can have a choice of 3, 4, 5, 6 possible measurements. You can have 3, 4, 5, 6 and more possible objects entangled that you're simultaneously measuring. And these generate higher order inequalities if you assume the kind of locality or relativistic causality constraints. And you can construct toy models which don't violate the Bell inequalities but will violate these higher order ones. So they have to be non-local, even though they don't violate Bell inequalities. Is this interesting? Well, we know they've got to be wrong for starters because reality has actually violated Bell inequalities, but it's interesting to explore, perhaps. Possible theories which violate Bell inequalities but do not violate the higher order inequalities. Again, we're trying to pin down what exactly do these different inequalities mean? What would the violation of a particular equality mean? Well, first of all, you have to understand what's the range of physical models that actually could do these things or can't do these things. Then we could also do toy models which do things quantum mechanics cannot do. Now, this is cool, because these would be the kind of things that maybe would be candidates for future theories. Future theories that go beyond quantum theory in the way that quantum theory goes beyond classical mechanics. And one of the examples of this that's been well studied is called Popescu-Rolick non-local boxes. These don't permit signaling faster than light, but they violate the Bell inequalities by an even greater amount than quantum theory can. When we look at the Bell inequalities, quantum theory can only go up to 2√2. There's an additional set of inequalities called the Cyrilson bounds. Local theories go up to 2. Quantum theory goes up to 2√2. The Popescu-Rolick non-local boxes go all the way up to 4. And that's logically the maximum thing you can get, given you're adding up 4 things that can each maximum be 1. But there could be a hierarchy of such theories. And by looking at these things, well, we might actually suggest situations where we can go out and do the equivalent kind of tests that we've done for Bell inequality, and we might find situations where the Cyrilson bounds are exceeded. And that would be a direct experimental evidence that quantum theory is wrong and that we need further theories. And there's more. Emergent classicality. If the world's so quantum, why does the everyday world behave classically? So there's a whole bunch of theorems about how classical behavior emerges from a quantum background. And relativistic mechanics. We occasionally, when worrying about relativity, actually go back and say, well, how does actually classical relativity work for many body theories? And it turns out that's actually a lot more less well known than is known. If you look at your textbooks, you will very rarely find two-body classical relativistic mechanics. You will find one-body classical relativistic mechanics put in a field. And the reason why is because in the 1960s, there's a theorem proven. The only relativistically invariant Hamiltonian mechanics for two or more particles involves straight-line trajectories. It's called the no-interaction theorem. You will very rarely hear that. But it turns out there are actually just simply problems with classical relativity theory. And when we want to understand quantum relativity theory, maybe we actually need to go and look at classical again. Hey, also, looking at quantum relativity theory, can you send signals faster than light? Actually, there are some situations where it looks like even that might be possible. Although there's worries about how much energy. We've talked about classical quantum mechanics on particles, but of course, what we want to do is field theory. But field theory has problems, many problems, and we need to study that as well. And of course, there are experimental tests, which we do. And that's the precision testing of the interference, collapse models, non-equilibrium models, Cyrilson bound models. There's actually places where we can go out and we can actually look and we can do experiments. So we've got to the end. I think if I want to summarize, how I did actually really think this. Quantum phenomena can be understood, We've looked at ways we can understand quantum phenomena. On the first look, it looks, wow, that's weird. We can't understand that. Yes, we can. But there doesn't seem an easy or right way to do it. All approaches involve something that seems unreasonable. Anybody that says, everybody else has got an unreasonable approach, therefore my approach is the right one, is basically being rather deceptive. As one guy says, it's not which one do you like the most, it's which one do you hate the least. Progress, that doesn't mean you can't make progress. We actually have made a great deal of progress in understanding what common assumptions are tenable, what things are not. If you want to have wave function realism and no collapse and no extra structure, you really are forced, more or less, into an Everett-type position where you believe in the reality of the other outcomes. If you want to have a hidden variable theory, you can, but it has to be non-local. Experiments can be and have been performed. We're not just performing nasal gazing. We're not just worrying about imponderables. We do actually do experiments. And as a guideline, if you're in any attempt to do this, here's a few guidelines of what you should do. One, you should be logically consistent. It seems odd to actually have to say that, but it seems it is necessary to point this out. A little bit harder, because it's not something we're so trained to be. We're trained to be mathematically consistent. We're trained to be very careful about our mathematics and our logic. But conceptually clear and coherent is difficult, because philosophers trained to do this, but physicists no longer get taught to do this. There's lots of cases where we use words in one context and we use the same word in a different context, and we understand from the context that that's what we're doing. We have to be very careful that if we define a word to mean something in one context, that we don't then use it in a different context with the same definition and pretend we haven't taken that definition over. Because we find you can get in situations where something sounds reasonable, but then you think, hang on now, if I'm using this new definition of it, that's not reasonable anymore. Maybe you're using it to do different things and you need to separate those meanings, hyphenate them. You have to pay close attention to the language you use. It has to be compatible with the observed phenomena, really, really. And that does mean you do have to pay attention to the fact that you have to account for the fact that how do we actually see one thing and not the other? And most of all, be honest. Be honest about the strengths and be honest about the weaknesses of your approach. Don't advocate your approach, hide its weaknesses, and attack the weaknesses of everybody else. And finally, I think that would sum up a very good attitude to quantum theory. Any questions?